A report released this week from the Iowa Department of Public Health shows new HIV diagnoses are up 27% from 2015. What's behind the uptick? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Claire Roth. This hour, I'll talk with Dr. Jeffrey Meyer about some possible reasons Iowa's HIV infection rates have increased and what can be done to change them. Also, we look back on the Republican National Convention with the Gazette's Todd Dorman and look forward to the Democratic National Convention with the Iowa Democratic Party's chairwoman, Andy McGuire. That's all coming up after this news from NPR. It's a news buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ben Kiefer. After an eventful week in Cleveland, the Republican National Convention has come to a close. Todd Dorman, columnist at the Gazette, was there this week, and he joins us now coming back from Ohio to discuss the highlights. Hey, Todd.
Hi.
So you spent a lot of time with the Iowa delegation, which got a fair amount of press when one member walked out of the convention. Here's some audio from that member, Cecil Steinmetz, who talked with C-SPAN about Monday's failed effort to force a roll call vote on the convention's rules.
I didn't quit the Republican Party. The Republican Party quit me. I have had my fill of it. The way they did yesterday and during the Rules Committee just proves that they are not for the delegates. They are for tightly controlling in just a few people so they can control the whole thing.
So you met with Cecil. Can you expand on his decision to walk out?
Well, he was part of a sort of a movement of delegates that were hoping to force a roll call vote on the rules on the convention floor. And with hopes that the rules would be defeated and then they could be amended so that delegates who were under rules that they were bound to vote for Donald Trump because of the primary results in their states would be free to vote their conscience and with hopes that they wouldn't nominate Donald Trump. The effort to force the roll call vote failed. Folks like Cecil Steinmetz accused the Trump campaign and party leadership of using sort of strong-arm tactics to bully some of the states that might have otherwise been open to having the roll call vote. Eventually, the rules were passed by a voice vote. There were protests on the floor. There was a lot of chanting and shouting, and it was kind of an ugly scene for a while. But in the end, the rules went through, and the Never Trump or the anti-Trump forces basically made their last stand and lost.
How do you think that day set the scene for the rest of the week?
Well, I mean, it was an unusual convention, to say the least. You had that scene on Monday. You had the plagiarism allegations swirling around Melania Trump's speech. On Thursday night, Ted Cruz gave a speech that was well-received until the moment where he told the delegates they should vote their conscience. And as I mentioned before, that idea of voting your conscience had sort of been the idea advanced by the anti-Trump forces, and so they booed Ted Cruz, and it turned into another sort of ugly scene on television. And so, yeah, I mean, it was, I think this, you know, conventions are always intended to show party unity behind the nominee, and this week in that convention, there were shows of unity, but there were also these moments where it's pretty clear that not all Republicans are enamored with the idea of nominating Donald Trump.
Mm. You sketched out an outline there of how the Never Trump movement was basically quashed at the convention itself, but what implications does that unrest that you mentioned have leading up to November?
Well, I think right now, coming out of the convention, there are a lot of delegates, and there were a lot of Iowa delegates who were, you know, Ted Cruz supporters or supported other people during the caucuses and during the primary process who now have become at least comfortable enough to support Donald Trump, especially a side of Hillary Clinton who they think would be, you know, would make a lousy president, obviously. So going forward, though, the performance of the Trump campaign, how they handle the, you know, their events going forward, the ground game organization, all of that. I mean, they have these this Republican support right now, but it's fragile enough, as evidenced by some of the things that happened at the convention, that if things were to go poorly for the Trump campaign, they could probably lose some of that support and would maybe see sort of an erosion of what they hoped would be kind of a unified Republican front going into November.
Governor Branstad's son, Eric Branstad, is the Iowa director for Trump's presidential campaign. He was at the convention. What hints did he drop about how that campaign will play out in Iowa?
Well, he told reporters that were speaking with him, I believe it was on Monday or Tuesday, that in his words, the lion would be unleashed. That's what he referred to as the Trump organization, that soon they're going to announce their team, they're going to have a plan, it's going to be put in place, and it's going to be, you know, obviously they say it's going to be successful. Eric Branstad said that of all the campaigns he's ever worked on, he hasn't seen the sort of enthusiasm as he's seen for Donald Trump, people calling them, asking for volunteer opportunities and what they can do. I mean, that's sort of been a knock on the Trump campaign, is that they don't have the sort of robust organization that Hillary Clinton has built in a lot of states. They don't have the staff on the ground, the offices, sort of the precinct by precinct volunteers that Clinton's campaign does. Eric Branstad says they're going to have that, and that they're not worried about playing catch up.
Shifting focus away from the Republicans for just a moment, Eric Branstad's father, Governor Terry Branstad, was also at the convention. You talked with him about rumors that U.S. Secretary of Agriculture and former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, one of the leading contenders to become presumptive Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton's running mate. What was Branstad's take?
Well, he sort of tried to beg off and say that he doesn't like to comment on the maneuvers of the other party and their vice presidential pick. But, you know, he also talked about the fact that as agriculture secretary, he's had a pretty good working relationship with Tom Vilsack. And he did sort of discount the idea that Vilsack's spot on the ticket would make it more difficult for Trump to win Iowa. So, you know, there was some talk about it at the convention. I didn't hear a lot of talk about Tom Vilsack among the Republicans. I think everybody's just sort of waiting to see what Hillary Clinton's pick will be.
Before we go, when you were in Cleveland, you dropped by a bar that some Iowa delegates had gone to unwind. In your column, you proposed a drinking game. Do you want to share a few of the rules that you spitballed there?
I wrote so much this week, I can barely remember what I said. It was basically they've heard so many of the same phrases during speeches that, you know, maybe they could, you know, have a drink every time someone chants it. Lock her up, which was something that was heard at the convention floor every night that caused a little controversy. But, yeah, I mean, they actually started off the convention with a reception at a place called the Bourbon Street Barrel Room, which is in the Tremont neighborhood in Cleveland, which is kind of a cool sort of gentrified neighborhood with lots of bars and restaurants and things. And then they also had an event at a brewery, Market Garden Brewery. And so there seemed to be, you know, a thread through the convention, beer, wine, booze, which is, I mean, it's American politics, so I guess that's not so unusual.
Okay, Todd Dorman, columnist for the Gazette, thank you so much for sharing your experience at the RNC, and safe travels back to Iowa.
Thanks.
The Democratic National Convention is taking place next week in Philadelphia, where Iowa's 44 Democratic delegates will cast their support for the presidential nominee. Yesterday, Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters spoke with Iowa Democratic Chairwoman Andy McGuire about what she expects heading into next week. He started the conversation by asking whether she expects all the Iowa delegates to throw their support to Hillary Clinton, despite the fact that Bernie Sanders received nearly half the vote in the Iowa caucuses earlier this year.
Well, I certainly think we'll be very united behind our nominee, Hillary Clinton. You know, it was a historically close caucus, and we've been very sensitive to that. Bernie Sanders brought in a lot of really energetic, good, new Democrats, and Hillary Clinton brought in a lot of good, new Democrats. So what we've got to do now is go forward with our one candidate. We knew we'd get here. We're going to go forward behind Hillary Clinton. And I think as we get farther on and we look at the choices, when you look at the choices of, you know, someone who believes in equal work or equal pay for equal work or minimum wage or wants to make sure that everyone can succeed. And what the other party is offering, I think that stark difference will be so obvious that I think everyone will unite behind Hillary Clinton.
Are there any Bernie Sanders supporters that are on the fence? We've seen reports of those that are going to still go to Philadelphia. They're not going to support Clinton. I mean, how are you approaching those delegates?
You know, I think some of them are still having trouble getting their arms around it, but I just hope when they look at that difference that they will say, you know, when we're talking about Supreme Court justices and when we're talking about women's rights and when we're talking about the differences in how people are treating the different races and the kind of almost racist statements that have come out of the Republicans, and we talk about the inclusion that we really have in our party, I think there's so many issues like that that I think people will come around to being unified.
A little bit. It's natural to compare since the Republicans have had their convention first, but we won't get too into the comparing. But one thing that's been noteworthy throughout the Republican National Convention is that there has been a lot of unification over the negatives on the Democratic candidate. And you have somebody like Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, who talked a lot about unifying the party and didn't really mention the presumptive Republican nominee. You have somebody like Ted Cruz, the Texas senator who won on the Republican side, who got up and would not even endorse the presidential candidate. Are the Democrats going to have a negative tone, or are they going to be a little more positive in theirs?
You know, I don't think we will have that kind of tone. I think we'll have a very optimistic and progressive going forward tone. Really, we are unified on the issues. And when we talk about where we want to lead this country, I think that's what we're going to be talking about. And really, we are unified behind Hillary Clinton much more than their party is behind Donald Trump. And that's, I think, because of his hateful rhetoric. And Hillary Clinton has really put out a great vision for where she wants to take this country and how she wants to build on the progress that President Obama has made. So I think also there's the historic nature of Hillary Clinton being the first woman to ever be nominated by a major party and possibly be president. I think that's pretty cool.
Now, shifting gears a bit, the caucuses, like we said, long since gone. What has changed for the party, for the Democratic Party in Iowa, since those Iowa caucuses took place, the results came in, and where we are now when you look at the Democrats approaching the convention?
Well, one thing, we're a lot bigger party than we were, which is wonderful. We brought in a lot of new Democrats, which both candidates did, and that excitement is
really
wonderful.
And you're talking about actual numbers of registered
voters. Actual numbers, yep. We've got a lot of new Democrats, and that really translates all over. You know, we're looking at up and down the ticket. Certainly the national convention's about Hillary Clinton, but we're really looking up and down the ticket to see how we can make sure that, you know, we have the get the House back here in Iowa, that we can increase our numbers in the Senate, that we can get more congressmen from our congresswomen from Iowa, and we can get a new senator. So those are kind of the races that I think will really help that kind of enthusiasm that the caucus generated.
There's also been a lot of talk since the caucuses about superdelegates. Can you explain that to those that don't really understand the superdelegate process? Because it is different than how the Republicans do it.
It is, and it's a process that was created a long time ago. And the idea was if I'm a Senator Harkin, or I'm a Dave Loebsack, or I'm even an Andy McGuire, who's the chair of the party, and I run against a regular person who's a voting Democrat, I'm probably going to win that delegate slot. And so what they decided to do was take those people out and take them and make them superdelegates so that your actual convention delegates would reflect the actual voter, which I love the idea. Now, what's happened is over the years that's gotten played with a little bit, but that's still the concept. But now people feel like those people have sort of can overrule what the actual voting public wants. That was never the intention. And so we don't actually do anything with this in Iowa. This is something that's done at the DNC level. But I think the DNC will look at that. That's not the intention of these delegates. And I think they will modify it, I would guess, or at least talk about and discuss how they could make it better.
With the results of the caucuses being so close, there was a lot of press on it after it happened. Looking back now that we're this many months down the road from there, do you think that hurt the status of Iowa being the first in the nation for going first and picking presidents?
Well, it's interesting. When you look back, when we were the first one and we were so historically close contest, I think people were sort of shocked by that. Well, then when you looked, we just actually historically close contest in a lot of different states. So we didn't look quite so different once you looked at all the states. We're having a caucus improvement committee. We're trying to look at how we can make it better, especially the logistics of it. Long lines, trying to use more electronics, trying to make sure that we have venues that fit people. And that's a good thing because that means we have more Democrats. And this really is a party building structure. So I think it hasn't really hurt it in that way. People know that, you know, it's really good that you can look people in the eye in Iowa. And I think people understand, especially in this day of Citizens United, that you need to be able to look people in the eye, shake their hand, and realize if they're really the person you want for president. And I think Iowa does that extremely well.
Now, you've long been a supporter of Hillary Clinton. In conversations you've had with her, why do you support her as the nominee?
Well, and I'm an uncommitted delegate at this point because I am the chair of the delegation. But yes, I have been in the past a supporter of her, and certainly as our nominee, I am a supporter of Hillary Clinton. So I think she has the experience and the temperament that you need for someone who's going to lead this nation. You know, we don't know what the problem's going to be 2 years from now. And you don't know it, and I don't know it. And so we want someone who we know and we trust will have that temperament to be able to make the right decisions at that time. And that's not an easy job, as President Obama will tell you. That's not an easy job. And she is so well qualified to do that job.
I can count the number of pure toss-up states on one hand for this general election. Iowa is one of those. How much time is she going to be spending trying to get this vote in Iowa?
I'm sure she'll make us a priority. I know her campaign is making us a priority already. And we will be seeing, I think, a lot of her or her surrogates in Iowa.
And what are you expecting out of this convention? What are you planning for? When are you getting there? What do you think is going to happen?
I think it's just going to be a wonderful time to discuss all the great issues we have in this country and how we can solve those issues. It's really about solving them. It's about understanding that there are people who aren't doing as well. We've had a recovery under President Obama, but it hasn't been as much for some people. And we need to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to succeed. We need to talk about education. We need to talk about the opportunities from early childhood all the way to higher education. We need to talk about minimum wage. We need to talk about our working men and women. I'm very proud we have the head of ISEA as one of our delegates and the head of AFSCME as one of our delegates. That's wonderful because that means working men and women are represented and we're talking about those issues. And I have to tell you, I haven't heard much about those issues in watching the Republican National Convention.
And I got to ask it, any eye towards the Capitol? Are you thinking any more about running for governor?
Well, right now I'm very much focused on making sure we elect Democrats up and down the ticket from Hillary Clinton all the way down to, I talked to a supervisor yesterday in Muscatine County. So we got to make sure that we keep our eye on that ball, and that's what I'm going to be doing for the next several months. But I will tell you that I don't think the priorities in our governor's mansion are correct right now. I think we could have better priorities that would really lead this state forward. And if I could help with that, I would.
All right. Andy McGuire, chairwoman of the Democratic Party. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Clay.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ben Kiefer. The Iowa Department of Public Health's annual HIV surveillance report for 2015 finds there were 124 new HIV diagnoses last year. That's an increase of 27% from cases reported in 2014. Dr. Jeffrey Meyer is an associate professor of internal medicine at the University of Iowa and physician with the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Iowa City. He joins us now to discuss the numbers. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us. An increase in HIV diagnoses by 27% in 1 year. Help us conceptualize that.
Okay. Well, I would say one thing we know for sure is that HIV problem is not going away. And I would add to the last speaker, our discussants conversation, that maybe we should focus a little bit on STD education. The numbers sort of have to be interpreted a little bit in terms of looking at the trend over time, because there are fluctuations. And it is higher than our average, which is about 114 cases per year. And this past 2015 year, you're talking about there was 124 cases. We were disappointed because the previous year, 2014, there was actually only 98 cases. So we thought we were making progress. So we were disappointed that the numbers are not actually going down.
Mm. Do you have any idea of what a possible cause of the increase might be?
Well, that's a great question. So why? I'm going to, I guess, disappoint you in saying that I don't have an answer to that question. There's only hypotheses. I think that the previous year, 2014, numbers were probably the outlier. And there is some speculation that the rollout of the ACA sort of discombobulated the people and the system and the testing approach to HIV in the state, and that may account for the low numbers. But nonetheless, the numbers are not going down. And so we need to focus on the people at risk for HIV, and those risk groups are well known. It's the men who have sex with men account for the majority of the cases. Injection drug use is really a minority of cases in Iowa, and even though we've had the heroin problem in Iowa, we've not yet seen that connected to the number of the rise in HIV cases. So there's also been a slight uptick in the number of cases in the youth group, in adolescents, young adults, age 15 to 25, 24 in that range. So, you know, that we don't know what that is due to. We have seen an increase in the cases in the men who have sex with men risk group. So this is an evolving area. We're sort of digging down into the data to try to understand what's going on. But largely what we have are a bunch of hypotheses trying to figure things out as to why this increase.
Still a lot of unknowns.
Yes.
How good is Iowa at testing for HIV compared to other states, for instance?
Well, that's a great question, because as a state, we rank in the bottom 10% in terms of testing our population. The federal organizations like the Center for Disease Control and other professional societies would say that, you know, we should be testing everybody between the ages of 15 to 65 at least once. And Iowa doesn't do that well, and sort of the rationale for that is that Iowa doesn't have a lot of HIV. Okay, the prevalence of HIV in Iowa is low, and so the cost benefit, you know, is it really there? Because it is so low, the prevalence is in the bottom 10% of the nation, if you look at the state-by-state prevalence. So that's one of the reasons. Now, our public health officials in Iowa would say we should still be testing everybody between the ages of 15 to 65 at least once. We certainly need to be doing as much testing as possible in the groups of individuals who are at risk.
Mm. You said that the prevalence is low. Perhaps we're doing well at prevention. How could we be doing better?
Well, we can apply what we already know works in a better way, I suppose. We could direct what limited resources we have, and that's been one of the challenges at the state level, is federal funding for HIV prevention is going down, okay? So we have to do really more work with less. And so we have to use our precious resources smartly. And so that's created a challenge. There's also new approaches to try to curb the epidemic, and that is called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP.
Okay, well, hopefully we can talk about that more later. For now, we are out of time. Thank you so much, Dr. Jeffrey Meyer,
sure,
for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Coming up on the program, an Iowan perspective on Turkey, a Civil Rights Commission complaint that could push transgender rights forward in Iowa, and how one small Iowa town is preparing for RAGBRAI. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio, back after this short break. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ben Kiefer. Later in the program, I'll speak to a retired U.S. Foreign Service officer living in Iowa about the attempted coup in Turkey. And we'll learn how a town of less than 2,000 handles the influx of thousands of RAGBRAI cyclists. But first, Jessie Vrew is a nurse who's transgender and who's worked for the Department of Corrections for years. He's not allowed to use the men's bathrooms or the locker rooms at his place of work, and he's being denied medical insurance coverage for surgery. Here's part of Jessie's story.
All I want is for my employer to treat me like my coworkers by allowing me to use the worker restrooms and locker rooms that match my gender and by offering the insurance for medical care I need. I don't want different treatment. I just want the same treatment and facilities as every other employee. This is America. This is Iowa. Everyone should be treated fairly. That includes having equal usage of restroom and locker room facilities, as well as health insurance coverage for essential health needs.
With the help of the ACLU, he's filed a complaint against his workplace with the Iowa Civil Rights Commission. Here with me now is Jessie's lawyer, Rita Bettis of the ACLU. Thanks for joining us, Rita.
Hi.
So tell me a little bit about Jessie's story. How did he approach you with the complaint?
Sure. So we filed this complaint along with the National ACLU LGBT Project and then with a really wonderful cooperating attorney in West Des Moines, Melissa Hasso with the Schrinian and Hasso Law Firm, this week. And you may know this, but Iowa is among a group of 18 states now that expressly protect against discrimination on the basis of gender identity in our state Civil Rights Act. And that's been in place in our civil rights law since 2007. But Jessie's employer, which, as you've noted, is the state in this case, the Department of Corrections, is not allowing him to use men's bathrooms and locker rooms. And it's also denying him health care benefits for procedures that are substantially the same as those that it actually covers for his colleagues who are not transgender, for those who are cisgender. So, Jessie's experience was similar to a lot of people who are transgender in that Jessie knew that he was a man from a very early age, despite being assigned the female gender at birth and being raised as a girl. And so in 2014, he was diagnosed with gender dysphoria. And for listeners who don't know what that means, it's a profound and clinically very significant sense of distress. It's associated with depression and anxiety, all sorts of implications for work function and life function. And so he came out at work and he informed his employer at that time, 2 years ago now, that as part of his transition, he would soon need to begin using the men's facilities exclusively. Mm. So he gave his employer plenty of time. He asked for the development of a policy that would comply with the, in place since 2007 Iowa Civil Rights Act to provide transgender employees, not just himself, with a safe and non-discriminatory work environment. And for a while, his employer indicated to him that they were in the process of drafting such a policy. There was this meeting that took place with the warden and the medical director. But in the end, after all that really, I think, remarkable patience on Jessie's part, they abruptly told him they would not be developing a policy after all, and they said the reason was, quote, that transgender issues were too controversial in the news. And so instead, they gave him a separate space, one that is genderless, to use instead. So what they ended up doing was to put a locker inside of a unisex bathroom. And all of the employees have use of the bathroom, not just Jessie. So this sometimes means that he can't access his belongings or get to the space because it is single use and other employees are using it. But it also means that he lacks any access to a shower, which all of his other colleagues have. And for those of us who don't shower at work, this may not seem significant. But considering the nature of Jessie's job as a nurse in a prison, it really is. So just as one example, among other things, he was recently exposed to pepper spray as part of a chemical agent training that all of the employees had to do. And as a result of this very discriminatory, separate and not equal facility that he has, he wasn't able to remove the pepper spray for a significant period of time. And that, of course, led to headaches and other problems that lasted for days.
You mentioned that Jessie's story and that what Jessie has gone through is very similar to what many people who are transgender have gone through. And I'm wondering how common this type of policy that the Department of Corrections has is in Iowa?
So transgender people have for a long time been subject to egregious discrimination, and that's true in Iowa too, despite the fact that we have express protections against that kind of discrimination in employment in our Civil Rights Act. And so that really underscores the importance of what Jesse is doing in being willing to fight this, really not just for himself, but for transgender people across the state. And, you know, from our side, we would hope that the state of Iowa, which is not only obviously one of the largest employers, just has thousands of employees, would be setting an example on that basis in complying with the Civil Rights Act and providing a safe and non-discriminatory work environment. But because it's the state, it's particularly problematic and egregious. So it also means from our perspective that it's not just a statutory issue of compliance with the state Civil Rights Act. It's also a constitutional issue because the state of Iowa is actually depriving Jesse of equal protection on the basis of his gender identity. So that's an equal protection violation in addition to a state Civil Rights Act violation.
Mm. We reached out to the Iowa Department of Corrections. The assistant director there, Fred Scaletta, gave us this statement. Quote, as a very important part of the Department of Corrections mission, the department strongly focuses to protect and treat with respect the public, staff, and offenders. Due to a pending civil rights complaint, the department cannot comment at this time. What do you see as the next steps in this case?
Sure. So the complaint is the first step in being able to bring a lawsuit that's filed in district court. We may or may not get to that stage. It may be that the state recognizes that this is unlawful behavior and seeks to remedy it, in which case we may be able to resolve it before we get to that stage. The complaint will sit with the Civil Rights Act for at least 60 days because that's the minimum period of time that it has to be with the Civil Rights Commission itself before we can get what's called a right to sue letter. And during that time, the commission will engage in an investigatory and screening process. And so they'll decide if there's a probable cause of discrimination or not in this case. And, you know, for our side, this is really such plain and clear wrongful discrimination on the part of the state that I think our hope is that the state would work with us to resolve this quickly.
Okay. Rita Bettis, lawyer at the ACLU, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. An attempted coup in Turkey last week left almost 200 dead and more than 1,000 wounded. It was an attempt to bring down President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. With me to contextualize the coup is retired U.S. Foreign Service officer Janice Weiner. She was a U.S. diplomat for 26 years and spent a quarter of her career in Turkey. Hi, Janice.
Hi, Claire. Thanks very much for having me.
Yes. So knowing what you do about the country, were you surprised by this coup?
I was surprised because for two reasons. One, in the age of the internet and multiple satellite television channels, it's as well as after a series of trials against certain military officials that happened about a decade ago, it seemed as if the age of coups was over in Turkey.
Okay. So what can you tell us about the aftermath of it?
What I'd first like to say is that the response of the people to the coup attempt was remarkable. When Erdogan called on people to get out into the streets to oppose the apparent coup attempt, thousands or tens of thousands of people went out. It was an enormous show of people power by parties across the board. Every single political party was against the coup itself.
Wow. That's shocking. So what do the Turkish people want from their government? What are they not getting?
It's the Erdogan has spent 13 years in power now, and many of those years consolidating power. He's someone who seems to really be paranoid about something like a coup, and he has always also not been one who's taken kindly to criticism by the press, by media, by others. He is very sensitive to that. But I also want to say that we don't really know exactly what happened a week ago Friday. We don't know the extent of it. We don't know who did it. All we know is that Erdogan, who's the president, it's actually a parliamentary system with a prime minister. But Erdogan has been trying to lay responsibility at the feet of an elderly cleric, Fethullah Gulen, who actually lives in the Poconos in Pennsylvania, and his organization. And there's been, since the coup attempt failed, there's been enormous purges taking place, and not just in the military.
Wow. So Turkey's now declared a 3-month state of emergency. What does that mean for democracy there?
We'll see. Under the current constitution, a state of emergency can be declared for up to 6 months. The cabinet requested a 3-month state of emergency. The parliament approved it. Two parties approved it, the ruling AK party, Erdogan's party, as well as the nationalist party, the MHP. The other two parties opposed it, but it passed handily. Never before has a state of emergency been declared for all of Turkey's 81 provinces. This is a first. In the late 80s and 90s, there was a prolonged state of emergency in the southeast as the state and the Kurdish militant PKK battled.
Have you had any contact with people currently in Turkey?
I've talked to a couple of people there, as well as someone who just returned.
What's their experience?
The society is very polarized there right now. Some people think, yes, it's we have to root out whatever evil there is that caused this. But many others, I think, are extremely concerned at the extent to which the purge is going. They have taken into custody at least 10,000 people right now, and another 40,000 have been either suspended from work or their investigations ongoing against them. So this is not just military now. These are also civil servants, academicians, judges. Two judges from the Constitutional Court are among those suspended. They have put a ban on travel by academics. So I think a lot of people who would normally be giving opinions are now very reluctant to do so because they simply don't know what's going to happen.
So how do you believe this will impact Turkey's relationship with the West?
I think it's already impacting its relationship with the West. Turkey has been a very solid ally in a very difficult area of the world. They're a member of NATO. They have Incirlik Air Base near Adana in the south, and we have been using that air base to fly sorties out against the Islamic State. I believe that a lot of the people that we knew, that people at the embassy and others knew, are now in custody, including the general who was in charge of Incirlik Air Base. The long-term damage to the military from this, for a critical ally that's surrounded by countries such as Syria, Iraq, and Iran, we don't know how that is going to look going forward. And the economy is taking a hit there. The value of the Turkish lira has plunged. The stock market has plunged. Tourism had already taken a hit because of previous bombings there.
Wow. So we'll have to wait and see how this continues.
I think there certainly will be people, including one or both of the parties that voted against the state of emergency, trying to hold the government to account and try and preserve the democratic values. And we'll see what happens, because under a state of emergency, the military and security forces have the right to disrupt public gatherings and demonstrations.
Okay, Janice Weiner, thank you again for joining us to discuss the attempted coup in Turkey.
You're very welcome.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. RAGBRAI, the Register's annual Great Bike Ride Across Iowa, kicks off Sunday, and upwards of 20,000 people are preparing for festivities in the stops along the route. One of those stops is in Leon, Iowa. The city of 1,900 people is preparing to host tens of thousands of people, 15,000 to 17,000 bikes, and 20,000 vehicles. With me now is Shannon Erb, Vice President of the Leon Chamber of Commerce. Hi, Shannon.
Hello.
So tell me a little bit about the preparations that Leon is going through.
Sure. Well, we were first notified in January that RAGBRAI was going to come through, and our planning pretty much started right away then in February after we were notified. And so the planning process, we've kind of structured our volunteers that are helping out into, we've got everybody split out into about 19 committees, and there are seven of us kind of overseeing all of those 19 committees. So each committee has a few volunteers, and we have all got kind of different responsibilities that we've spread out to make this event happen with our population that's about 19,000. And as you can expect, we need as many hands on deck as we can to host the 20,000 people coming through.
Did you say 19,000 or?
1,900.
1,900, okay. So has Leon hosted a RAGBRAI stop before?
We have hosted an overnight stop once, and that was in the early 80s. And then we've also been part of RAGBRAI as a pass-through town a couple times in the early 90s. But it has been quite a while since we've had RAGBRAI through, and I think the number of riders has grown significantly since the last time we hosted.
I was going to say, I can imagine it would be quite different now than it was in the 1980s.
Yes.
So how much does it cost for all of these plans to be set in motion?
The executive committee has a budget of around, we're hoping we can get by with spending about $90,000. And that does not take, that's pretty much just our expenses ahead of time. That doesn't really take into account the expenses that we'll have that day as far as purchasing food, beverages, and that sort of thing that we'll kind of buy as an as needed basis that day. So overall, the event is probably going to cost upwards of $150,000.
Wow. Will the town make that back?
We have our fingers and toes and arms and legs crossed that we will. We think that we will get very, very close to covering all that budget. One of the best things about Leon is all of our folks are used to being in a small town. That's the culture that we have in Leon. And as part of that, we're all pretty scrappy, so we're finding lots of donations of materials and, different tables and chairs that we need to use and people donating their time. So we've been able to get by, I think, on a much lower budget than a lot of other towns, which is going to be very helpful for us in the end.
Wow, that's great to hear. So tell me a little bit about the events that are going to be happening that night.
Sure. We have three bands that are going to be playing that night in Leon, and all of our activities are going to be held on our square, which is kind of in the center of town. We still have a traditional courthouse and a main square in our town. So we have a local band that's called Stone Lizard, and they're going to kick things off at 4 p.m., and they're going to play until 6 or 6:30. And then our next band is an internationally known band called Vocal Trash, and they play music on recycled instruments.
Oh, wow.
Yep, and they're going to play from 6:30 till about 8. And then our closer for the evening that's going to get everybody up and dancing and moving is called Rhino, and they are out of Minneapolis, and they do all genres of music, and I think most of them are covers, but we'll get to, hit every type of music that riders want to hear. So, and they're going to play until about 11:30 that evening.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of fun. So I have to ask you, have you ever ridden RAGBRAI?
I have not. The only experience I have with RAGBRAI is I used to live in a town in northeast Iowa, and we had RAGBRAI through there quite a few times when I was younger, so I used to get to sit on the curb and wave to all the riders, but I have not ridden myself.
Okay, well, maybe after this stop you'll be inspired. Who knows?
I may be.
Okay, Shannon Erb, Vice President of the Leon Chamber of Commerce, thank you again for joining us.
You're welcome.
If you have been on Iowa State University's campus lately, you may have seen a white squirrel. It's a type of fox squirrel that has the unusual combination of white fur and dark eyes. Tim Stewart is an ecologist with Iowa State. He says there's a reason this species of white fox squirrels is doing well on campus.
In a wilder environment, so a woodland, for example, would probably be quite visible to predators and would not survive long enough to reproduce. And so the likelihood of these genes being very prevalent in the succeeding generations would be fairly low. But in an urban environment, many of these predator populations are gone or they're just relatively low. And so that provides these animals with a refuge. And so the gene can be continually passed on from generation to generation because the individuals are not being selected against. And in addition to that, because people tend to be a little bit protective of these white squirrels. They may be more likely to feed them and maybe avoid them with their car simply because they can see them more easily. That's another possibility as to why these white squirrels tend to persist in urban and suburban environments.
Even with the growing numbers of white squirrels on campus, it's rare to catch a glimpse of one. Tim recommends heading over to Lake Laverne on Iowa State's campus. If you can't get to Ames this weekend, we do have a photo of a white squirrel on our Twitter page. Check it out at IPR Talk. And that does it for today's News Buzz program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon, with production help from Graham Bly. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can find past editions of our program at iowapublicradio.org, or you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcasting platform. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Claire Roth. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.